This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. Ever since John McCain sought and won the endorsement of Pastor John Hagee, a quote from Hagee's 2006 interview with Terry has appeared in many places, including CNN, Newsweek, The New York Times, and The Daily Show. As you've read or heard that soundbite, you may have wondered what else John Hagee had to say in that interview. So we're going to play it back for you, and Terry will explain the story behind it. But first, here's part of that soundbite that's been used so frequently since the endorsement. This is Pastor John Hagee on how Hurricane Katrina was, as Hagee described, God's retribution for a homosexual parade that was about to take place in New Orleans.
All hurricanes are acts of God because God controls the heavens. I believe that New Orleans had a level of sin that was offensive to God, and they were recipients of the judgment of God for that.
Hurricane Katrina was not the focus of my 2006 interview with Pastor John Hagee. The main subject was a lobby group Hagee had formed earlier that year called Christians United for Israel, also known by its acronym, CUFI. CUFI follows what its website describes as a biblical obligation to defend Israel and supports Israel's right to the land by biblical mandate. Hagee also believes that the second coming of Jesus is imminent. There are 10 prophetic signs of the end time, he says, and Israel figures into at least 4 of them: plague in the Middle East, the rebirth of Israel, the Jews returning home, and Jerusalem no longer being under Gentile control. Here's an excerpt of a sermon from Pastor John Hagee's collection, Jerusalem, Countdown to Crisis.
In May 1948, Israel was reborn. How many of you were alive on May 15th, 1948? It was the most important prophetic day of the 20th century. Why? Because Jesus said in Matthew 24:32, when you see the fig tree, national Israel, begin to bloom again, know that my coming is nigh at the door. Behold, one generation will not pass away until all things are fulfilled. We are racing toward the end of time. We are not living in the last days. We're not living in the last hours. We are living in the last minutes of the dispensation of grace. In 1967, the Six-Day War united Jerusalem under Jewish control. Why is that important? Because the Gospel of Luke says, when Jerusalem is no longer trodden down by the Gentiles, then shall the end come. The Bible says, when the Lord builds up Jerusalem, when he builds up Zion, he will appear in all of his glory. So the Bible is screaming, when you see Jerusalem united, when you see it beautified, when you see it built up, the Messiah is coming. And when you see these signs in the heavens and the sun, the moon and the stars, and the waves of the oceans that are roaring, what did God say? He said, lift up your heads and rejoice. Your redemption draweth nigh. I want you to do it, Cornerstone. Rejoice. The King of Glory is on the way.
Pastor John Hagee organized a Washington summit in July 2006 to introduce his group, Christians United for Israel, to senators and congressmen. Speakers included Ken Millman, who was then chair of the Republican National Committee, and Senators Sam Brownback and Rick Santorum. President Bush sent a recorded greeting. Senator Joe Lieberman spoke at CUFI's second annual summit last July. Before I spoke with John Hagee in September 2006, I spoke with Israeli journalist Gershom Gorenberg about why CUFI is controversial among many Jews. Gorenberg wrote about the Christian Zionist movement in his book The End of Days. Here's a short excerpt of that interview with Gorenberg. What is your understanding of Christian Zionism?
Well, I would say that in the first place, it's something of a contradiction in terms, because the people who promote the idea of Christian Zionism are looking at Israel in mythological terms. They're seeing the Jews as actors in a Christian drama leading toward the end of days. Real Zionism as a Jewish movement is a movement aimed at taking Jews out of the mythological realm and making them into normal actors in history, controlling their fate and acting for pragmatic reasons connected to the here and now. So what's called Christian Zionism is actually very distant from Zionism.
What are the specific political and territorial goals that you think Christian Zionists have for Israel?
Well, they take a position on Israel and on the Middle East that would put them at the far edge of the radical right within Israeli politics. They're opposed to any concession whatsoever of land for peace. They tend to treat any process leading toward peace as an illusion, if not a conspiracy. Some of their leaders at various times have spoken explicitly of the idea of expelling the Palestinians from the West Bank. These are all positions that, as I said, would put them on the radical right within Israel. They're deeply opposed to the idea of a Palestinian state. They tend to support military action over diplomacy. It's worth stressing that this puts them far from the mainstream of Israeli politics.
I've spoken to some Jewish Americans who consider themselves, aligned with Christian Zionists, and I asked, well, do you think it's in your ultimate best interest to be aligned with groups whose ultimate goal is the second coming of Jesus? And to which they've responded, well, we as Jews know that that's not the real truth, that that's not going to happen. So why not have an alliance with people who support the same goals for Israel that we do? The same kind of political goals. And why not support people who just are going to back Israel and back the protection of Israel? What would you say to that?
I think that, first of all, there's a tremendous disrespect implied here, strange as it may seem, for the beliefs of the Christian Zionists. These are people who live very much by their theology, and this attitude says their theology is irrelevant to me. I'm not relating to them as believing people. So I find that ironic. The second thing is, I think that there's a misunderstanding here of what an apocalyptic vision is. When somebody says that they're hoping for the end of history, for God to come and fix the world, they're saying that they see something broken in the world as it is today. Part of the end of days vision of the Christian Zionists is that the Jews will die or convert to Christianity. So what they're saying about the world today is they don't see Judaism as a legitimate religion. And I think it's strange for Jewish groups to align themselves with people who show, a theological hostility for Judaism.
When you say that, in this scenario of the rapture, Jews will either convert or die, my understanding of that is that in this version of the rapture, that all Christian believers immediately ascend to heaven, and everybody else is that can either convert and ascend to heaven too, or they remain on earth for the tribulations, which is a series of plagues and famines and wars and other catastrophes.
Yes, that is true. This is a view of all so-called non-believers. But normally in the documents of this religious stream, there's a particular focus on the Jews, because for this form of theologically ultra-conservative Christianity, one of the great scandals remains that the Jews have not accepted Christianity. They believe that a literal reading of the Bible necessarily, in their eyes, leads to an acceptance of Christianity. The Jews are the keepers of the Hebrew Bible, and it's stunning that the Jews continue to refuse to read the Bible in what they consider to be its simple meaning that would lead to Christianity. This is the cognitive dissonance which is at the core of their beliefs, and they expect the end of days to resolve this dissonance. I would add one more thing about these kind of scenarios. If you read their literature, they inevitably end up with the Battle of Armageddon on Israeli soil. All events are expected to lead to this immense conflict, which will take place in Israel. The verse that's cited over and over again is that the blood will flow as high as the horse's bridle. So they're expecting war and conflict, and they're seeing this as something positive. Everything that would lead toward Middle East peace, they see as an illusion. For Israelis looking toward their country's security and future in this world, in history as it continues, the most necessary step for us is finding a way to peace. So the people who are proclaiming their support for Israel are actually working at cross purposes to Israeli interests and needs.
Gershom Gorenberg, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
That was Israeli journalist Gershom Gorenberg, originally broadcast on September 18, 2006, just before my interview with Pastor John Hagee. Hagee says the rebirth of Israel and the restoration of Jerusalem is a prelude to what else needs to happen in Israel before Jesus returns. In this excerpt from one of Hagee's sermons, he describes what will happen just before the end of days and the second coming.
In 2 minutes, let me tell you where we're going from here. This prophetic portrait paints the following sequence of event for the future. America and Europe become weakened and cannot respond to Israel in the time that Russia and the Arab invasion begins against Israel. This is God's plan. Why? Because he wants the Jewish people in Israel and around the world to know that he, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saved them, not America. Secondly, Russia with Arab allies will plot and plan Israel's destruction. That's happening right now. It has been happening for 10 years. Iran's nuclear weapons have been produced with Russian scientists. The Islamic Arabs are using the roadmap to peace to get all of the land of Israel they can get. And when Israel finally says enough, you're going to see the beginning of the implementation of Ezekiel's war in 38-39. The critical point is the church is raptured before this war begins. I am telling you that makes this message one of the most thrilling prophetic messages you've ever heard in your life. You could get raptured out of this building before I get through finished preaching. We are that close to the coming of the Son of Man.
Here's my 2006 interview with Pastor John Hagee. Pastor Hagee, you say that when Israel finally says enough to attempts to take its land, you'll see the beginning of the implementation of Ezekiel's war. What is Ezekiel's war?
Ezekiel's war, in chapters 38 and 39, it's known in the Bible as the war of Gog and Magog. And in Ezekiel 36, God gives the promise to the Jewish people that he's going to bring them out of their Gentile graves. This was given through the prophet Ezekiel when the Jewish people were in captivity. In 37, there is the dramatic presentation of the Valley of Dry Bones that come together to become an exceeding great army. This is a physical portrait of the nation of Israel that has been, if you will, in Death Valley for almost 2,000 years, because from the diaspora of 70 A.D., until the reentrance into Israel, May 15, 1948, they were in Gentile graves. And then in Ezekiel 38 and 39, the prophet Ezekiel very explicitly describes the war that's going to happen at some point in our future, where Russia organizes Islamic nations to come against the state of Israel. And the end result of that war is that God himself is going to stand up and defend Israel, and the enemies of Israel are going to be crushed in such a dramatic fashion, quite similar to Pharaoh in the Red Sea, that all of Israel will recognize that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is indeed the Lord.
In your interpretation of biblical prophecy, what has to happen in Israel before the rapture?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. There is no Bible prophecy that needs to be fulfilled before the rapture of the church.
But there's things you don't want to happen. You've said that you don't want Jerusalem to be divided as part of any peace plan. You didn't want Israel to withdraw from Gaza, and you don't want it to give up any territory in the West Bank. Why not?
Because the Bible has a very specific verse in Joel, the 3rd chapter and the 2nd verse, that says almost verbatim what I'm going to quote to you based on which translation you will be reading. And if the Bible says that I, the Lord, will cause the nations to come down to the Valley of Jehoshaphat for judgment. And the reason that I'm going to judge the nations is because they have divided up my land and my heritage, the people of Israel. So that verse very clearly says that any nation that forces Israel to divide up their land will experience the judgment of God.
And what will happen during the rapture?
What will happen during the rapture is that Paul writes in the New Testament that in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, the dead in Christ shall rise, and we which are alive and remain shall be caught up to be with the Lord in the air. That means instantaneously every believer will leave this earth.
Now, most Christians who believe in the rapture believe that the believers who will be raptured are Christian believers.
It's a misnomer for the Baptist, the Presbyterians, the Catholics, the Pentecostals, the Methodists, whomever. I know when you hear their preachers preach, you get the idea they're the only ones going to heaven. That's one of the reasons I have a non-denominational church. I was raised in a denomination, and many times I heard the exploits of the denominations being touted more highly than the exploits of God himself. But there is no market on who's going to heaven. Only God himself knows who those people are who are walking and living as they should.
But everyone else who I've heard talk about the rapture believes that it's Christian believers who will go to heaven. Jews, Muslims, non-believers will be left behind to face the tribulations on earth.
Well, there are Jewish people who believe in Jesus Christ, and there are Arabs who believe in Jesus Christ. So you don't have to be a Gentile to be a believer.
But you do have to believe in Jesus Christ.
Yes, you do, to be a part of the rapture.
Pastor John Hagee has been in the news since his endorsement of Senator John McCain. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with Hagee, the interview from which his comment about Hurricane Katrina was excerpted. Hagee is the founder of Christians United for Israel.
You opposed the roadmap for peace, which required land for peace. You've said that giving up the West Bank or part of Jerusalem violates the word of God. How does it?
Joel 3:2 says, "Do not do it. Those who divide up the land of Israel will come under the judgment of God. Therefore, don't do it." It's just that simple.
What about Israelis who want a practical solution to living in peace in the Middle East and who believe that land for peace might be a viable, perhaps the only really viable solution? Would you say you can't do that because of what the Bible says?
No. No, I'm not saying I'm forcing my beliefs on you, but look at it from a basic analysis of common intelligence. You only do something because it benefits you. You negotiate something because you get something from the negotiation. Show me one time in Israel's history in the past 58 years when giving land has brought them peace, and I'll say that they would have a point in logic. But at this point in time, they've given away Jordan, they've given away the Sinai Peninsula, they have given away Gaza, they have backed out of Lebanon. It has benefited them not one iota. It hasn't brought them one day of peace. It has brought them nothing but additional military confrontation. We've given these land bases away to become nothing but a base for global terrorism 1,000 yards from the walls of Jerusalem.
Would you like to convince American Christian groups that Israel should be a more important part of their agenda?
I would like to convince American Christians that they have a Bible mandate to support Israel, to pray for Israel, to speak up for the peace of Israel, to pray for the peace of Jerusalem, and to be a blessing to the Jewish people because that is the biblical mandate that we have. We may have a political difference with the prime minister, and I have made this very clear to Prime Minister Olmert. I wrote him a letter shortly after he was elected and wished him well and told him that he would be in my prayers and in my thoughts, and I wished him every success, and this was before the war began. But I said in that letter very specifically that I must disagree with your policy of giving land away to the terrorist organizations. And he has a political philosophy that disagrees with the biblical position that we have, and we'll just agree to disagree. But meantime, we're going forward. We're doing everything that we can to benefit the people of Israel, to bless the people of Israel, because they are, in fact, the nation.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with Pastor John Hagee, the founder of the group Christians United for Israel, also known by its acronym KUFI. In addition to lobbying elected officials, KUFI educates Christians on what KUFI's website describes as the biblical and moral imperatives of supporting Israel. Pastor Hagee believes that the rebirth of Israel is one of the signs that the second coming of Jesus is imminent. Hagee has been in the news since his endorsement of John McCain. Many news publications and TV shows have quoted Hagee's statement that Hurricane Katrina was God's judgment against the city of New Orleans for a gay pride parade that was about to be held. The statement is from Terry's interview with Hagee, which we're rebroadcasting today. Here's another excerpt from one of Pastor Hagee's sermons, included in his collection, Jerusalem, Countdown to Crisis.
For those of you who are in Washington, Jerusalem is not up for negotiation with anyone for any reason at any time in the future, regardless of what your roadmap for peace calls for. There are people in this nation who still believe the Bible takes precedent over Washington, D.C.
Pastor Hagee, if you believe that the Bible takes precedence over Washington, D.C., I would assume maybe you'd think the Bible takes precedence over the Israeli government as well. If you use the Bible as the basis of policy, is there any room for compromise? And if you use the Bible as the basis for policy, then should Muslims be using the Quran as the basis of their policy? And again, what possible room for compromise is there at that point?
There's really no room for compromise between radical Islam.
I'm not talking about radical Islam. I'm just talking about Islam in general.
Well, Islam in general, those who live by the Quran have a scriptural mandate to kill Christians and Jews. Now, I had an Islamic on my television show last week. His name is Waleed Shubat. He was raised as a Palestinian terrorist and at one time was placed a bomb around himself and was supposed to walk into a bank. And I said, Waleed, I'm trying to understand the definition of what is a radical Islamic person, because I've read many books, many magazines, and I can't come up with a good definition of what constitutes a radical Islamic. And he says these words, and I'll quote them. He said, anyone who truly believes the Quran is willing to kill Christians or Jews. That's waging jihad. He said, now, those people who are willing to go into another country and start a war will only be about 15% to 20% of Islam. There are 1.3 billion people who follow the Islamic faith. So if you're saying there's only 15% that want to come to America or invade Israel to crush it, you're only talking about 200 million people. That's far more than Hitler and Japan and Italy and all of the Axis powers in World War II had under arms. That is a massive number of people. So while we may define radical Islam as a minority because there are so many, it is still an overpowering military potential.
But what you said is that all Muslims have a mandate to kill Christians and Jews. Do you believe that?
Well, the Quran teaches that. Yes, it teaches that very clearly.
So for you, there's absolutely no way of tolerating Islam at all. I'm not talking about extreme Islam. I'm just talking about the Muslim religion.
Well, there are Islamics who want peace, but they don't have center stage right now. And whenever Islam, radical Islam, does things that make the headlines, like getting on a bus with a bomb strapped around them and killing people. The moderates do not speak up because they're afraid that they will be killed by the radicals. So it gives the appearance that there are no moderate Islamic people. I've been to Israel 21 times. I've gone to visit Islamic people who I consider to be peaceful. They want peace as much as I do, and they're terrified. The particular businessman that I talked to has sent his 5 children to California because he's afraid that he will be burned out of his business because he's not extreme enough. And he asked me if I would pray with him, but would I please come into his office, shut the door, and put the blind down before I did so, because he's afraid of being seen in any kind of an association with a Christian. Now, that's not what you call an environment of tranquility.
Are there wars in the Middle East prophesied in the Bible, do you think, before the rapture and the second coming?
The Bible makes a very general statement that there will be wars and rumors of wars. And then in another instance, it refers to the wars as being like a woman who is in the process of having a baby. In other words, where the contractions began, and once the contractions began in these series of wars, just as in having a baby, the contractions become more severe until the baby is born, so will these military wars become more severe before the end of the age. So I believe that we have entered into this point of time and where there will be one war that follows another, and each one of them will be more severe than the other until we finally reach the Battle of Armageddon, where there is a massive military entourage fighting for global supremacy in the Middle East.
I just want to ask you one question based on one of your sermons that and this isn't about Israel. You said after Hurricane Katrina that it was an act of God. And you said when you violate God's will long enough, the judgment of God comes to you. Katrina is an act of God for a society that is becoming Sodom and Gomorrah reborn. Do you still think that Katrina is punishment from God for a society that's becoming like Sodom and Gomorrah?
All hurricanes are acts of God because God controls the heavens. I believe that New Orleans had a level of sin that was offensive to God, and they were recipients of the judgment of God for that. The newspaper carried the story in our local area that was not carried nationally, that there was to be a homosexual parade there on the Monday that the Katrina came. And the promise of that parade was that it was going to reach a level of sexuality never demonstrated before in any of the other gay pride parades. So I believe that the judgment of God is a very real thing. I know that there are people who demur from that, but I believe that the Bible teaches that when you violate the law of God, that God brings punishment sometimes before the day of judgment. And I believe that the Hurricane Katrina was in fact the judgment of God against the city of New Orleans.
So I know you're very opposed to homosexuality, but you think that the whole city was punished because of things like the forthcoming gay pride parade.
This is true. All of the city was punished because of the sin that happened there in that city.
You've said that we could get raptured any second. In one of your sermons, you basically said we could get raptured before this sermon is even over. What are you doing to prepare?
I'm doing what I do every day. I live right. I read the Bible. I pray. I try to treat other people like I would like to be treated. And I'm going to leave the rest to the grace of God.
And do you still believe it's imminent?
Oh, I do. I do. I do. I do.
And by imminent, any second, any moment.
I would not be at all surprised if I saw the Lord before the day ended today, but if he doesn't come today, 10 years from now, I'll be looking for him with the same intensity.
Pastor Hagee, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you for the opportunity.
John Hagee is the founder of Christians United for Israel and the pastor of Cornerstone Church, a megachurch in San Antonio. His interview with Terry was recorded in 2006. Since the part about Katrina has been quoted in so many places, we thought you'd like to hear the entire interview. Chris Gaffney, guitarist, singer, and accordion player for the Hacienda Brothers, died last month at age 57 after suffering from liver cancer. Yet he and group co-founder Dave Gonzalez have a new CD, their fourth, set for release next month. It's called Arizona Motel. Variety described their music as, quote, fusing elements of Mexican border music, American soul, and Bakersfield honky-tonk country, unquote. The Hacienda Brothers described their music as Western soul. Here's a taste from the most recent Hacienda Brothers CD, What's Wrong with Right, which includes It Tears Me Up, a song from the album's producer, Dan Penn.
I see him kiss your lips, squeeze your fingertips, and it tears me up. It's a cold, cold world I'm living in. I turn my back and there you are with my best friend. Sometimes we pass on the street, darling. You look at me as if to say, I'm sorry, my sweet. Maybe by saying sorry ain't good enough. But you look at me with that certain smile. Baby, it tears me up.
In addition to his recordings as one of the Hacienda Brothers, Chris Gaffney played with Dave Alvin's Guilty Men and with his own band, Cold Hard Facts. Terry spoke with Chris Gaffney in 2006 and asked what led him to the hybrid of soul and country music.
Well, I listened to soul music all my life when I grew up. Basically, I was like a big Otis Redding fan. Played in a few bands, Western bands. Played a little while with Webb Pierce and Ferlin Husky. I just played bass then, never sang. But when it came time to sing, I liked country and soul. If you live long enough, you're going to hear a lot of music. And those are the two favorite types of music that I like.
Before we get to some originals from What's Wrong with Right, I want to play another song that will be familiar to a lot of our listeners. So this is a Cowboys to Girls that was a hit for the Intruders in 1968. It was written by Gamble and Huff, two of the guys behind the Philly Sound. So why did you choose to do this song?
I graduated in 1968, and it was one of those songs. It was a magic song that year. It was one of those songs that got people on the dance floor. And if you had your lady with you, that was the one you wanted to dance to. I have been known to go out on the dance floor by myself.
Which is particularly hard to do with a slow dance, isn't it?
Yeah, slow dancing with myself.
So let's hear Cowboys to Girls. This is the Hacienda Brothers from their latest CD, What's Wrong with Right.
I remember when I used to see you jumping rope, up and down, baby. I remember when you got your first baby coat. But you were young. You're a woman and I'm a man. It's my lips you're kissing.
Hacienda Brothers from their CD, What's Wrong With Right. Chris, I read that you were a boxer before you became a professional musician, and you actually won a Golden Gloves tournament. Is that right?
Yes.
What year?
Yes, you can call me 1967.
That's great. So how did you start boxing?
I started awkwardly. Boxing is very unnatural, but I had a slick trainer, and then later on, I hooked up with Jackie McCoy, who had 5 world champions. And I got to be in the ring with some great people. And since I wasn't much of a, what they call a one-punch knockout artist, I just learned how to work hard and make moves and slip and move and give angles. I've never been a handsome man, but my nose is not all jacked up. And if you look at the pictures.
Right. You have a song that you wrote on the new CD, What's Wrong With Right, that's about boxing. It's about a boxer.
Uh-huh.
It's about...
I wrote that about the great Barry McGuigan from Belfast. We have... Well, he had a world championship belt. I don't have that. But his dad used to sing Danny Boy before each and every one of his fights. My dad would come to all my fights, and in the dressing room, he would sing things like Everybody Loves Somebody Sometime, you know, because my dad was a partier. Pat McGuigan, Barry's dad, would sing Danny Boy before each and every fight. And he passed away a month before Barry fought Stevie Cruz from Fort Worth for the title. And I could see it in the way Barry moved in the ring, that he was just not all there. He went the whole 15 rounds, but it was pathetic. All his strength had been sapped from him. You know, and of course I'd throw in a line about Las Vegas, but that's not what took it out of him, mm-hmm. You know.
Well, this is a great song, and I'd like to play it. And the song is called If Daddy Don't Sing Danny Boy Tonight, and it's written and sung by Chris Gaffney.
I was a fighting champion from Belfast, Ireland, when I kissed my mother goodbye. Dad had gone 1 month before I looked in her dead eyes. She said, I know you're strong and I know you're brave, and in my heart you're mine. But I fear for you down in my soul if Daddy don't sing Danny Boy tonight. Las Vegas heat, it sapped my strength beneath the ringside lights. And a brown-skinned boy from Fort Worth, Texas, is trying to take my life. But my title, it's worth more to me than even drawing breath. So in memory of my dear old dad, I'll fight him to the death.
So how did you get into music from boxing?
I guess I got lucky.
Well, you said, you know, you used to play, well, you still play accordion, but I think you started playing it when you were a boy. What were you playing? Why was accordion your instrument?
Well, this is an odd story, but I'll synopsize it. There are those people that come in the neighborhood, well, this is in the 50s, that either sell you accordion lessons, or there's a guy with a Shetland pony you can get your picture taken on. My parents couldn't afford a piano, so they thought that I should go to Joe Vandervoek's Central School of Music to learn accordion. And it was a bummer. It was because I'm very much into sports. And looking out your window at people playing, throwing the football while you're playing Lady of Spain is a bummer. That's how I got into it.
So when you started playing in bands, did you see a place for accordion in it?
No, I had no. I wanted to be in UFO. I wanted to be in a rock band.
Chris Gaffney, speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. He died last month at age 57. His fourth CD with the Hacienda Brothers, Arizona Motel, will be released next month. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews Reprise. This is Fresh Air.
You may live in a city or way out in the country. You may live in suburbia. If you got the time to take, I've got some prime real estate. Let me tell you what I have found. We're going up, up on Soul Mountain. See my little pretty one. I'm pulling up, up on Soul Mountain. Stay there till the day is done. Going up, up, up.
The freewheeling Norwegian film Reprise is about two budding novelists whose pipe dreams of cult stardom crash into the realities of growing up. The movie, the feature film debut of 34-year-old Joachim Trier, played to rave reviews at the Sundance and Toronto film festivals. It opens today in New York and Los Angeles with a national rollout to follow. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
At a screening in New York of Joachim Trier's marvelous film Reprise, Trier mentioned that one of his greatest influences is Annie Hall. On the surface, Reprise is nothing like that Woody Allen comedy, but there is a connection. When it came out, Annie Hall was the perfect expression of Allen's sensibility, essentially a stand-up routine with flashbacks and free associations and jokes that exploded the realistic surface, yet somehow deepened the emotion. In Reprise, the two male protagonists are 20-somethings who've written first novels, and in the opening, they go together to a mailbox and drop in their manuscripts. The film that follows has the spirit of a rambunctious first novel. It's a weave of memory, fantasy, digression, and wry narration. But the trickiness doesn't distance you, because Reprise, like Annie Hall, has a core of feeling. It's as if you're pinging around the hero's imaginations, darting in and out of the real world. After Philip, played by Anders Danielsen Lee, and Eric, played by Espen Klumen Hoyner, mail off their work, the narrator spins a fantasy of what they expect to happen with quick illustrations. They'll be published to commercial indifference, but cult success. They'll struggle with celebrity. One will run off to Paris and have a tragic love affair with a gorgeous depressive. Finally, after a separation, they'll bump into each other at a cafe and collaborate on a novel that inspires a revolution in Africa. What actually happens is not quite that. Philip's book is accepted right away, but bouts of mania and depression and an affair with a student named Carrie, played by Victoria Vinge, sends him to a mental hospital for 6 months. Eric's novel is rejected, but after a rewrite, he's inducted into a world of madly pretentious and ambitious authors and editors. Broadly, Reprise is a coming-of-age story in the mode of Barry Levinson's Diner. It tracks Philip and Eric and a few of their pals as they stagger into a world that can't be adapted to suit their male adolescent expectations, especially in regard to women. But the movie's content is inseparable from its voice. When a man jogs by them in a park, we get a digression on that stranger's sad relationships. We don't see the face of Eric's girlfriend, whom he takes for granted, until she breaks up with him for being a cliché and suddenly becomes real. Reprise skips along, but when it stops, because these are Scandinavians, and it's not in their character to pirouette on the surface. Eric, who's gangly and earnest, tries to pull his morose friend out of the depths, but Philip is out of sync with the real world. When he reunites with his ex-girlfriend after his hospital stay, he tries to recreate their first vacation in Paris, dressing and posing her like she was then, as in Hitchcock's Vertigo. but the soundtrack almost never matches the images. The words are behind or ahead. It's a little arty, but like the great scene in Annie Hall, where subtitles spell out the awkward subtext, Reprise's cinematic gimmicks, its very syntax, springs straight from the character's unconscious. Reprise features a Salinger-like author, whom Eric reveres, who had huge success but became a recluse. The writer praises Eric's novel, but adds he didn't like the last part. He says, "Don't try to be poetic." Trier himself takes that old novelist's advice. He tackles poetic themes, like chance versus determinism, but they're not what keep you watching breathlessly. What's liberating about this film isn't so much the content. It's the voice of a young artist, both disciplined and unfettered. You'll come out humming the syntax.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.